Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
And 90% of the innovators that we featured were young people. And the idea is to put this on a global platform and open up opportunities for those young people to find investors.
This year's three-day Youth Connect Africa Summit ends in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, Friday.
There are people praising government. There must be people criticizing government. In between the various foresters, there must be some truth on it somewhere. I don't have a problem with those who think slightly different the way that I think, because there are over 200 million Nigerians who are free to think and they think different.
A prominent cleric calls on Nigerian President Muhammad Buhari and his government to reveal the names of all sponsors of terrorism in the West African country.
To ask the authorities to really immediately and unconditionally release the MPs, stop using maximum force, including live ammunition, to stop protests and creating an environment in which only violence is starting to become commonplace.
And Amnesty International calls on Eswatini to drop all charges against two lawmakers without preconditions. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. This year's three-day Youth Connect Africa Summit ended in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, Friday. Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo opened the meeting. The conference welcomed Africa's youth, their leaders and top-ranking African government officials, lead innovators, entrepreneurs, and UN officials. Hosted by the Ghanaian Youth Ministry of Sports and National Youth Authority in partnership with the United Nations Development Programme, or UNDP, the summit was themed Africa Beyond Aid, positioning the youth for the post-COVID economy and the African Continental Free Trade Areas, or AFCFTA, opportunities. The aim of the summit, organizers say, was to connect youth to thought leaders, peers, resources, technology, skills, as well as economic development opportunities. Youth Connect is an initiative described as a unique, homegrown, and innovative drive that connects youth to government and private sector jobs, as well as entrepreneurship opportunities. Ms. Ahuna Ezekonwa, the UN Assistant Secretary General and the UNDP Africa Director, was a high-profile official who attended the Youth Connect Africa Summit. For more about the three-day conference, I reached Ms. Ahuna Ezekonwa via Skype in the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
We started in Rwanda with the President of Rwanda really having this initiative. And we saw that there was a proof of concept that it worked that when we started to build a platform and bring young people to connect with each other, but also to connect to opportunities for job creation. And we started to see more jobs created in that context. This, you know, started in 2012. It became, you know, an Africa initiative adopted also by the African Union. And we started to have countries sign up. Today we have over 20 countries that have launched Youth Connect initiatives in their countries because they see the value. It is helping to create jobs. And we're finding that this is also working because the talent is there, the interest is there, the drive is there, and the innovation is there. Because, you know, we're talking about a generation that is much more educated, much more connected, and have at their disposal digital technologies.
Now, we all understand that youth unemployment is the biggest problem facing the African continent. How is this summit going to help address the unemployment challenges? Or is it just going to be one of those talk shops with no action?
The reason why we have this Youth Connect and why young people always want to come, actually, we're always oversubscribed because the people who are coming together are people who are serious about contributing to solving this problem. The young people who are coming together, they're young people with ideas, and many of them are already doing things. They are not sitting idle and waiting for a job to be created for them. But they want support. They want support to ease some of the challenges that they are facing when they go back home. Challenges of financing, challenges of regulatory environment, challenges of access infrastructure, challenges of movement. So we're able to connect some of those challenges to solutions that could come from policy, but also we bring in private sector. Private sector needs to be part of it because government alone cannot provide this enabling environment. Private sector needs to understand that youth are an asset, that you know they could make a huge contribution to the economy. And when that happens, private sector also gains. So it's a win-win. So we've got financial institutions as well who are brought in, because the more they hear from these young people and get some visibility on the dynamism that lies behind their visions, the more they can take these young people more seriously.
Talking about the African Continental Free Trade Area, what are the opportunities for the youth and how can these be translated into real benefit?
Yes, through Youth Connect, we're making sure that those opportunities are not on paper, but that they can actually become meaningful. And this is why we have the Secretary General of the Secretariat here. The AFCFTA Secretariat is here in Accra, and the Secretary General is participating in this summit, giving information to young people on what they can do to leverage this new market, but also picking up some of the experiences of the young people in terms of what stops them from going all the way. That exchange is quite vital because it's still early days in the business, and we are coming in early because we don't want this to advance with bad habits. How can young people benefit from that is the question we're asking. We're doing studies around this, and we're turning these into policy decisions, policy frameworks that would allow this to happen.
How is the UNDP supporting the youth to take advantage of the African Continental Free Trade Area, or the AFCTA, and contribute to sustainable development?
So data is important. Not only identifying the challenges, but also the opportunities. And then we make that available to the young people. We're connecting the policymakers and the decision makers with the youth and sort of bridging that gap that you sometimes find and what needs to change. That's another way. I think also giving visibility to youth innovators. You know, during COVID-19, we saw a lot of innovation coming out of Africa, out of necessity, right? And UNDP published a magazine which we called Africa Innovates. 90% of the innovators that we featured were young people. And the idea is to put this on a global platform and open up opportunities for those young people to find investors.
Ms. Ahuna Ezekonwa is the UN Assistant Secretary General and the UNDP Africa Director. She spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. A prominent Nigerian cleric is calling on President Muhammadu Buhari and his government to reveal the names of all sponsors of terrorism in the West African country. Bishop Matthew Hassan Kuka, head of the Catholic Diocese of Sokoto, a major city in northwest Nigeria, expressed concern about the ongoing security situation in the country. He also says the rate at which citizens are losing their lives in Nigeria through a wave of kidnappings, banditry, and terrorism is unacceptable. This after the United Arab Emirates recently published the names of six Nigerians who were prosecuted for their close affiliation to Boko Haram. The cleric's remarks come as civil society and opposition groups express concern about what they say is the worsening security situation in the country. They say kidnappings, banditry, armed robbery, and violence carried out by extremist groups, including Boko Haram, have increased. They are calling on the government to do more to protect life and property. In part one of this interview, Bishop Matthew Hassan Kuka tells me that the Nigerian government must do more to protect life and property and should also reveal the names of those who sponsor the terrorists.
The people wreaking havoc on us are going by different names, from unknown gunmen to, when we are feeling the impact, we cannot seem to put names on what is happening. And all we've had so far, people there are stories about numbers of arrests and so on and so forth, and then the reintegration of bandits who have abandoned banditry so on and so forth. So the government has said, you know, a lot of people have been arrested. But there's quite a lot of anxiety among Nigerians as to who these people are. And I think the general feeling has been that with no trials going on, there is a lot of cynicism about what exactly the government is doing, and that many people feel that this puts a dent on the integrity of the intention and purpose. So really, essentially, it's about let's put a face on who the perpetrators of this violence are in our country.
Bishop Kuka, some people are suggesting that if the government were to expose or reveal the names of those who are sponsoring or behind these terrorism acts, they will go underground, or the investigations could be hindered or thwarted, or some evidence hidden. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I think the first thing here is credibility. And I think government has to figure out the best communication strategy to create a level of believability in the minds of ordinary people. And there are all kinds of conspiracy theories that have been swirling around, some of them founded, some of them not quite founded. So I think it is in the interest of the government that it inspires confidence by a certain level of transparency. The people you're talking about going underground, we are told about people who have been arrested. This is the reason for the anxiety. So if you talk about them going underground, we can't arrest everybody. We cannot, it is left for the government to decide whether this will hamper the process of their investigation. That's why I said there is an urgent need for us to establish a level of believability so that all hands can be on deck. This is not a battle government can win alone. It's a battle of hearts and minds. It's not just about bullets and guns. It's also about winning the hearts and minds of people. But there is a general feeling that the criminals of yesterday are finding their way back into you know, being integrated into communities directly or indirectly.
Bishop Kuka, critics of the government have accused the authorities of treating arrested members of Boko Haram or those who have decided to lay down their weapons and former members of Boko Haram better than they are treating separatist groups such as IPOB or IPOB. What are your thoughts? Supporters of the government have dismissed some of these suggestions as an irresponsible accusation. What's your take?
Well, we shouldn't be playing ping pong with the lives of people. I mean, whether you belong to IPOB, people don't lose their citizenship by belonging to, groups that government is not happy with. Even members of Boko Haram, who are Nigerians, have not lost their citizenship. So really, at the end of the day, it still speaks to the issue of how the government can reach out in a way, a manner that is even-handed. Because in the final analysis, how you communicate with people, body language, all of these are the things that will lend credence to ordinary people about what they want to believe and what they won't believe. So again, it is this gap of lack of communication that is allowing this kind of narratives to be created. So really, it's not a question of these are perceptions, and they are perceptions that are the result of government not communicating effectively. And the real challenge is how government is communicating with people.
Some of your critics are saying that you are becoming too political and you are criticizing the government too much without necessarily offering solutions. What do you say to them?
My critics have got a right to be critical. The same way that I've got the right to be critical. So it's not, I think this is left for people to steal the chaff from the grain. My concerns have been the unforgivable number of people who are dying by the day in Nigeria. This is not acceptable by anybody. I think when people talk about criticizing government or what, I don't know what else there is to say. There are people praising government. There must be people criticizing government. In between the various choristers, there must be some truth on it somewhere. I don't have a problem with those who think slightly differently in the way that I think, because there are over 200 million Nigerians who are free to think and they think differently.
Bishop Matthew Hassan Kuka is the head of the Catholic Diocese of Sokoto. He spoke with me from Sokoto, a major city in northwest Nigeria. In Eswatini, the president of the Swaziland Democratic Nurses Union, or SDNU, is appealing to the international community to help transfer two injured nurses abroad for medical attention. Welcome Ndluli says the nurses were injured by bullets fired by security forces, including the army and the police, who tried to stop their protests. The SDNU, he says, subsequently resolved not to treat soldiers and police officers. Local media report members from the SDNU, who were joined by other healthcare workers, were attacked by the police and the army as they marched to parliament to present a petition to demand improved living conditions. The nurses also warned the government to stock its healthcare facilities with much-needed medication to enable them to treat citizens who get sick. The government has since banned all protests in the Southern African Kingdom, a move political parties and civil society groups say they plan to defy. They argue the ban is against the constitution, which protects their right to protest. For the latest development, I reach Welcome Ndluli, president of the Swaziland Democratic Nurses Association, or SDNU.
What happened is that on the 20th, when we arrived, the police, they came without even having some engagement with us, the leaders of unions. They started shooting at us with tear gas canisters, and the nurses, they started running away. We also ran away. They were shooting my car. When I parked my car, they shot my car with tear gas canisters. I started the engine and ran away. We ran away, but as a leader, I had to come back to see what was happening to the nurses. We came back as we were regrouping with the nurses. The police, they came again. They shoot at us and we ran away. And some of the nurses were able to run to hide in the nearest hospital, but others couldn't. And those who never reached there, they were shot by the police.
Welcome. How many of the nurses were injured?
In all the skirmishes, about 32 were injured. Two nurses, I will talk about the two nurses that are currently critical in hospital. We have even decided as a union to request help that we can get even in the international community. This nurse needs urgent referral in our country. Because one of the grievances we are having is the issue of medication. Our hospitals, they don't have medication.
But welcome. Yes. Eswatini's Deputy Prime Minister Themba Masuku told SABC that the police were deployed to protect property and that there's no truth that the police shot people in the street.
The Deputy Prime Minister, we know what he's capable of. You will remember when political unrest started in the country. He said the people that were shot by mercenaries that came in the country. But the king's spokesperson recently admitted that it was the soldiers. So we know that he is capable of telling lies to the people outside. I can tell you we have videos of soldiers of the police entering a bus and firing tear gas inside the bus and then locking the bus. After that, the people were being suffocated by the tear gas. They were trying to run away using windows. And when anyone who was coming out of the window was being shot by live ammunition. That's the fact. It's true, we have videos of that.
Your decision as a union president, refusing to treat these security officers, doesn't that go against the principle of treating everyone?
Yes, you are correct. Nurses are expected to treat everyone, regardless of color, race, religious affiliation, political affiliation, anyone. We have that obligation. But I must say this, the nurses right now, they are traumatized, they are scared. Because what happened, Peter, just that day in the evening, the police, they went to the nurses' compound, the nurses' home. They fired tear gas to their kids and they fired live ammunition, traumatizing the nurses and their families. And the nurses, they are scared of them. Not necessarily that they don't want to treat them. They are scared because to them, they might come saying you are here for medical care, yet they are here to kill them. I can tell you, we have a picture, Peter, of the soldiers soldiers now, not the police. In my clinic, yesterday, armed to the teeth. I don't know whether they were looking for me to finish me off. I don't know. So nurses are scared, not necessarily that they want to go against the principal, but we are so much scared, Peter. And when I go out, I must tell you, my wife keeps on checking if I'm still alive because we don't know what is going to happen to us.
Welcoming Luli is the president of the Swaziland Democratic Nurses Association, or SDNU. He spoke with me from the Eswatini capital, Mbabane. Amnesty International is calling on the authorities in Eswatini to drop all charges against two lawmakers without preconditions. The two lawmakers, Nduduzi Mabuza and Nthandeni Dube, are on trial charged with terrorism, inciting unrest and violating COVID-19 regulations. Supporters say the charges are politically motivated to intimidate and harass pro-democracy activists in the Southern African Kingdom. Supporters of the administration say pro-democracy activists, including the two lawmakers, seek to undermine the country's stability as well as threaten the kingdom's territorial integrity using the ongoing tension and unrest. They call on the government to deal with what they say are troublemakers who refuse to respect the law. This, as the government imposed a ban on all protests, a move analysts say is meant to suppress a wave of pro-democracy protests demanding democratic reforms. The two parliamentarians were arrested on July 25, weeks after pro-democracy activists embarked on a series of protests. Depros Muchana is Amnesty International Director for East and Southern Africa. He tells me that it is unacceptable for the two lawmakers to be detained for peacefully expressing their views.
MPs Nduduzi Bathede Mabuza and Nthandeni Dube were arrested on the evening of 25 July, I think, in 2021. Since then, they've been detained at Mbabane police station. And they face very vaguely worded charges under the Suppression of Terrorism Act, which, as you know, has been used and abused by the Swazi government or Eswatini authorities to really punish dissent, target pro-democracy protesters, and essentially instill a fear society in the country. And so we have been calling for the immediate release and dropping of all these charges against them, because in our view, and the view of Amnesty International, they have not committed an offense. They're exercising their fundamental constitutionally protected rights. And the use of the Suppression of Terrorism Act is yet another opportunity of the Swazi authorities to weaponize the law in order to limit and punish dissent.
What do you say to critics who are of the view that these two lawmakers sought to create confusion, threatening Eswatini's peace and stability, for which they have been held?
It is a travesty of justice to arrest two MPs, lawmakers for that matter, for peacefully exercising their freedom of expression and assembly. They have not committed any crime. Since May, over 80 people have been killed by security forces and many others arrested on suspicion of involvement in protests calling for largely political reforms and respect for human rights. These two MPs were part of that movement that is calling for the return of the rule of law, respect for human rights, and the Swazi authorities essentially protecting people who wish to exercise their constitutional rights. So there is no truth to the allegation that theirs is to promote instability, insecurity, and so on. These are the vague charges I was speaking about, which authorities in Eswatini are using to punish dissent, because by holding on to these two MPs on pre-trial detention, they are sending a chilling message to the rest of society that if we can do this to MPs, then we can do this to anyone.
What is your reaction to critics who are of the view that Amnesty International is interfering in the internal political dynamics of Eswatini, a Southern African kingdom, and that these two lawmakers are facing serious charges, including terrorism and contravening COVID-19 regulations by supporting these protests that turned violent recently?
Amnesty International is a global independent human rights organization. Its role is to speak out against human rights violations wherever they take place. We do that independently without fear or favor. Interference with internal affairs of Eswatini is the typical charge that authorities that are abusing the law like to use because they do not want any sort of feedback against what they are doing. MP Mduduzi Basede Mabuza and Mtandeni Dube were arrested for exercising their freedom of expression. Charges that are being brought under terrorism, Suppression of Terrorism Act, and the other cousin legislation, the Subversive Activities Act, are pieces of law that have no place in a modern rights-respecting society. They are used to impose a chilling effect on society. So I think we should be looking at the conduct of security forces. We should be looking at the conduct of the state where 80 Amaswati have been killed.
The UN Secretary General recently expressed concern about what is happening in Eswatini. Banned political parties, including Kudemo, have condemned what they said are excessive force being used to prevent students from protesting and demanding the government and King Eswatini should act. What is your take on the latest development in Eswatini?
That is encouraging to see the United Nations also speaking out and raising concerns of the deteriorating human rights situation. It's not only the United Nations. There have been African governments, including here in South Africa, who have spoken out against what is happening in Swaziland. I guess Swaziland authorities also accused the UN for interfering with internal affairs of Swaziland. A couple of months ago, SADC sent a delegation inside the country to consult with Swazi authorities as well as with civil society. They wouldn't have taken that position if all was honky-dory inside the country. The real call now is to Swazi authorities to really immediately and unconditionally release the MPs, stop using maximum force, including live ammunition, to stop protest and creating an environment in which only violence is starting to become commonplace. It is also important to resist the temptation to shut down the internet so that you can continue to guarantee free flow of information inside the country.
Dipros Muchena is Amnesty International's Director for East and Southern Africa. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, a former FBI cybersecurity expert says countries in Africa should learn from the American government experience to help combat cybercrimes. Tim Stranahan, who is now the Chief Operations Officer for Technium, a provider of cutting-edge technologies and telecommunication services, says there are state actors or countries who are engaged in cybercrimes targeting various countries. He says stolen intellectual property through cybercrimes can run into hundreds of millions of dollars. Andrew Heaton, CEO of Technium, says there's a rising cyber threat to Africa's national security. The continent, he says, faces a 100,000-person gap in certified cybersecurity professionals, which he says has to be resolved. Mr. Heaton also says some bad state actors can use stolen intellectual property and secrets to blackmail senior government officials. His remarks follow a report that the Ethiopian Information Network Security Agency has thwarted a cyber attack. The attack, the report says, was aimed at creating significant economic, psychological, and political pressure in Ethiopia. Analysts express concern that cybersecurity incidents mostly go unreported, unresolved. I sat down with Technium CEO Andrew Heaton and COO Tim Stranahan and began by asking them how cybercrimes are threatening countries in Africa.
Well, it's ever-evolving constantly because technology is evolving. People are learning new things. People are learning new techniques, whether it's with current technology or you know, legacy equipment. People are constantly figuring out new ways to abuse the system and take advantage of the innocent.
Tim, are there any state actors that purposely engages in cyber crimes?
Yeah, and I'll take a quote from Director Ray for the FBI. China is our number one concern. They are our greatest threat, and I think it's something that other countries should pay attention to as well. They're aggressive here in the United States, and certainly they're aggressive globally.
Have they acted in a way where they, you know, like steal documents or data from American companies or the American government.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff that China does, especially when it's concerning the U.S. government, a lot of that remains classified. But certainly against industry, you know, we talk about economic espionage, industrial espionage, where they steal intellectual property. And that's really like stealing our money. It's stealing our secrets. It's stealing our future. It's stealing economic security because they're very correlated. So our economic security is very much tied to our ability to protect our intellectual property. If we lose things that we're relying on to make our country better, stronger, and we lose it to an adversary or we lose it to another country, it gives them the benefit that we no longer have.
Tim, how much money are we talking about here in terms of the costs associated with the cyber crimes?
There's really, you'll hear a whole variety of costs, but I'll speak just about intellectual property. You're looking at $500 billion in loss, just in intellectual property. Cybercrime, because a lot of it goes unreported. So people don't know that they have actually been victimized. They've lost their secrets. Adversaries, more than China, they just don't advertise that they actually stole your intellectual property. They want to get into your system, maintain your presence on your system, take your information, and then exfil that information, and then they leave secret. And they want to leave a back door open on the system so that they can go in when they want. So it's not like a bank robbery when they go in and they sound the alarm. Oftentimes, companies don't even know they've been victimized.
So is there any other thing you want to add, Andrew?
Well, I mean, I remember just a Newsweek article here recently that I saw in the last few months of the Fortune 500 companies that different federal law enforcement agencies had gone into. They found every single one had Chinese malware on their system. And this is the U.S. where we're prepared for this. But if you are a leader of an African nation or an African company, most people aren't even discussing this, you know, to any large degree, aren't even aware of it. Here it's something we're fighting against and everybody's suffering from it. But outside of the U.S., companies are much less aware. And, you know, other things go on, too. For instance, you know, if you're a political leader, they catch you, they follow your phone, they follow, which is very easy to do these days. It's very easy. I mean, young kids can do it, you know, if they want to. You know, the spyware, the malware, you know, these things are out there. But state actors will do this for advantage. So, for instance, you know, let's say that politician has a couple of girlfriends on the side or something that could be used against them. Well, they'll go record that, and then they'll come back to them later when it comes time to negotiate something or there's something they want, or they'll even just set them up.
So they can use it to blackmail people?
Blackmail people, and it goes on all the time because a lot of people in the world are not educated and they're defenseless against these things.
So if some Western companies and even governments are not reporting these cyber crimes targeting them, how much less is Africa where people might not be aware of what is going on?
Right, and they might not have even, you know, might not have an agency to report it to that's even up to it. I mean, there are several countries that are very, very developed in this, like Rwanda, for instance, but there's many, the majority probably, that are not.
Here in the United States, Director Ray of the FBI has given statements about China's effort to steal intellectual property. And he says that this is a whole-of-government approach to steal intellectual property. So you should think the same thing for Africa and other countries where they have intellectual property that is of value. And the ability to protect yourself, recognizing that you're going against an entire government resources. So you have to be, there's no way to be totally secure.
Andrew Hayton is the CEO of Technium, and Tim Stranahan is the Chief Operating Officer at Technium and a former FBI cybersecurity expert. They spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Somalia's federal government is asking UN humanitarian agencies for urgent assistance to counter an ongoing drought and growing food insecurity, mainly in the southern part of the country. For VOA, Mohamed Kahiye reports from the Somali capital, Mogadishu.
According to UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, more than 5.9 million Somalis need urgent assistance, with 3.5 million of them facing acute food insecurity. Jubaland State in southern Somalia on the border with Kenya is the worst affected, as many farmers have lost their crops and many livestock owners have lost their herds due to poor rains. Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble called for urgent assistance to the affected people during an emergency meeting about the situation with some of his cabinet. He said his government has decided to step up humanitarian efforts to save the livelihoods of those affected by the worsening drought in Jubaland Regional State, noting the scarcity of water and food. He said he wants to send his appeal to UN humanitarian agencies in the country and to the international partners as well to also urgently provide help to those affected. Drought is not the only culprit behind the dire humanitarian situation, says Cindy Isaac, Orchard's deputy head of office in Mogadishu.
The humanitarian situation overall has been impacted not only by the drought, but also by the continued threat of the desert locust situation, particularly when we look at Somaliland and Puntland. And this has been further compounded by the impact of COVID-19, but as we all know, the political tensions that have surfaced throughout the year.
According to UN OCHA, funding for humanitarian aid has dipped to its lowest point in 5 years. The UN agency has appealed for $1.1 billion to help Somalia, but only 50% of that figure has been received. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo are holding joint cross-border training for law enforcement officers. The exercise is aimed at combating illicit wildlife trafficking and trade in the region. The illegal activity is becoming increasingly lucrative for the well-organized criminal networks behind it. For VOA, Catherine Nambi reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
A number of reports on wildlife trafficking have pointed out some of the factors that make Uganda an attractive transit route for traffickers in wildlife products from countries in the Central African region, especially the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC. Among those factors are Uganda's porous borders, weak law enforcement, and ineffective penalties and other deterrents. The most trafficked items are ivory and pangolin, which are mainly poached from DRC's Garamba National Park. The flourishing illegal trade has partly been blamed for fueling conflict and political instability that has led to the displacement of people. This is especially true in eastern DRC, where rebels like those from the Islamic ADF or Allied Democratic Forces have found safe haven. George Owesigire is the commissioner of Uganda's Wildlife Conservation at the country's Ministry of Tourism and Wildlife. He says the illegal trade in animals hurts the Great Lakes region.
Illegal wildlife trade is highly complex. It involves a lot of money, and there are sophisticated syndicates or criminal groups that operate internationally. So when they want to poach or hunt, they don't engage actively. They don't themselves go to kill the elephants. They stay in those luxurious exotic hotels, and they deploy our local people. Unfortunately, these guys who get a lot of money from illegal wildlife trade, they pay very little money to our brothers and sisters.
OYS Gile says Uganda has tightened its laws with strong penalties for whoever is caught transiting through the country with illegal wildlife products.
Because they knew our law was very weak, they would camp in Uganda, establish their cells, and then after they have packaged their materials, they proceed. We said we can't allow Uganda to be a transit route. Now, because our law is very strong, they are beginning to run out.
However, despite such efforts, international authorities continue to recognize Uganda as a trafficking hub for wildlife products. It is on this basis that Uganda is collaborating with the DRC to strengthen their law enforcement personnel to stop the poaching and trafficking of protected wildlife between the two countries. Pontius Izuma is the chief warden of Queen Elizabeth National Park. He says he's hopeful that after the joint training, Uganda and the DRC will be able to successfully work together to defeat wildlife trafficking.
So the thinking is that when they are informed, they're educated, they know what these are, they will not take part, or they will actually help us to contain this kind of illicit trade. And you are also aware that the illicit trade has various dimensions of dimensions it can translate into. So this training is going to arm them with the tricks these people use and how they use it. So in that way, we are very confident that we are going to curtail this illicit trade in wildlife trafficking.
Julian Sarah Ayesiga is the resident district commissioner of Uganda's Kabarole district that neighbors Queen Elizabeth National Park. She tells VOA that poachers and wildlife traffickers use very sophisticated tactics and urges security agencies to be extra vigilant.
For example, you will find someone trafficking an animal product, but when has put it in a milk can. So you may think that this person is transporting milk from some district to another district, and yet this person is trafficking maybe wild meat, maybe this person is trafficking ivory, maybe this person is trafficking some other animal product. So meaning that as the security, especially the security that is on road, the security that is concerned with wildlife, the URA customs, we all need to be keen.
The UN Security Council has gotten involved in the effort to fight the illegal wildlife trade with a recent statement addressed to the signatory states of the Peace, Security and Cooperation Framework for the Democratic Republic of Congo, as well as regional organizations and international community. The council urges them to coordinate their efforts to undercut the economic lifelines of armed groups that benefit from the illegal exploitation and trade in natural resources and wildlife. Available statistics indicate that poaching has led to a 75% decrease in the elephant population in Congo since 1996. The value of illegal trade of wildlife animals in Uganda is estimated between $7 million to $23 million annually. Elephant ivory fetches up to $250 per kilo on the Ugandan black market. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The World Health Organization has issued an action plan to address allegations that its staff and contractors engage in widespread sexual abuse and exploitation during a recent Ebola outbreak in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
An independent commission established to investigate these allegations issued a searing report on September 28th. It found international staff and local hires responding to an Ebola outbreak between 2018 and 2020 had forced dozens of women to exchange sex for the promise of jobs. The WHO says its plan for preventing similar abuse from occurring in the future puts the victim and survivor at the heart of its response. The plan outlines a series of reforms aimed at creating a culture of accountability and measures for bringing perpetrators of sexual exploitation and abuse to justice. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says neither impunity nor inaction in the face of criminal behavior will be tolerated. He says the WHO already has acted in this regard.
WHO has terminated the contracts of four people identified as perpetrators who were still employed by WHO when we received the report of independent conditions. Other people who have been identified as actual alleged perpetrators are no longer employed by WHO. And what WHO can do is make sure that their names are referred to UN database to prevent re-employment in the UN system.
Jazarevich says people accused of allegations of rape and other physical violence also will be referred to national authorities in DRC and in their national countries for investigation. He says many of the recommendations of the commission are being put into place during the newest current Ebola outbreak, which was detected in North Kivu province October 8th.
All staff who are deployed to the DRC for Ebola or recruited in the field are briefed on how to prevent sexual exploitation and abuse. They have signed the interagency code of conduct on this matter and completed the mandatory training. The briefing on preventing sexual exploitation and abuse has also been given to drivers and guards working with us.
As part of its victim and survivor-centered approach, WHO says it will provide livelihood support as well as comprehensive medical and psychosocial support for those who have suffered from sexual exploitation and abuse. The agency says it also will support children born because of these violations through educational grants and will cover any medical fees incurred. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Umependeza sana, mzidi kuniteka mzuri zaidi ya jana. Hatungekuwa na kasoro, tungefanana. Nimekupata wewe mapenzi ya Rabana.
From the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor William Igor, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the animal that is careful lives long in the forest. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.